Welcome to the 9th Pikes Peak Regional History Symposium, Disasters of the Pikes Peak Region. First off, I'd like to express our gratitude to Helen McCaffrey. Helen established the Helen and James McCaffrey Fund for Regional History here at the Library District, and they are the primary sponsors of the symposium, and we're very grateful to Helen. She couldn't be here today. But she has representative friends who I'd like to recognize. We have Nita and Nathaniel Peters and Ferris Frost. Could you stand up and thank you so much. Please convey our gratitude to Helen. Thank you. I'm frequently asked, why disasters? Well, I think it brings a crowd. That's a good deal. Some people asked me, is it because of the Mayan calendar prophecy? you know the one where on December 21st, 2012, the Earth comes to an end. No, that wasn't it. Some people asked if it was because of the 80th anniversary on June 10th. Now, today's June 9th. On June 10th, the 80th anniversary of the first recorded tornado touchdown in Colorado Springs. That wasn't it either. Well, then somebody asked me, well, what about the June 8th, 10th anniversary of the Hayman fire? No, that wasn't it. And then finally somebody asked me, was it because we had some prophetic knowledge that all hail would break loose this week? Well, yeah, that was it. Seriously. The ideas for the symposium topics, they come from you. It is now my privilege to introduce you to the president of the Pikes Peak Library District's Board of Trustees, Kathleen Owings. Kathleen?
Another disaster. That potentially could have been another disaster, so I'm glad it wasn't. Thanks, Tim. Thank you very much, and good morning. Thank you for choosing to spend your Saturday with us here. As Tim said, my name is Kathleen Owings. I am the president of the Board of Trustees for the Pikes Peak Library District. I have been on the board for 4 years. Hope to serve maybe six more if they decide to keep me on. I'm very proud to serve on the Board of Trustees and having and helping to host high-quality events such as the day we have here today with the annual history symposium, which reinforces really the joy that I have serving on the board and serving the community of the Colorado Springs region. Today's event is certainly guaranteed to be an emotional roller coaster, talking about disasters, as Tim said, with topics ranging from disastrous impacts of war, murder, greed, neglect, and the terrors of fire and floods. The day is packed with many presentations. We have allowed time for a light lunch. That is compliments of the friends of the Pikes Peak Library District. So thank you to the friends of all of our community branches out there for allowing that. During lunch and also the breaks, please take time to visit the bookstore, as you can purchase many of the materials that we have here from today, the presenters today, and also previous years. So please take time to peruse there. And also the Friends book sale, a plug for them. Please, you know, feel free to pop in there and see if you can find any new treasures for yourself or your family. Following the sessions, we will have a reception sponsored by the PPLT Foundation and a special appearance by Margaret Molly Brown, who survived the April 1912 Titanic disaster, so she's here today, which was 100 years ago. Through the symposium, subjects are very serious and have potentially very emotional impacts on individuals. We hope that you'll be inspired to learn more about the history of our region by reading books from your public library and also visiting the special collections in the 1905 Carnegie Library downtown. Please remember, lastly, that the Pikes Peak Library District is your library system. Quite honestly, it's all of our library system. And here we are here to enrich your knowledge of the community's history, so please enjoy that. And with that said, it's now my pleasure to introduce the Executive Director of the Pikes Peak Library District, Paula Miller. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I love it when this room is full this way. That's a beautiful sight out there. It's also my pleasure to welcome you here today to Disasters of the Pikes Peak Region. And one thing that we can promise is that this day will not be a disaster. It's beautiful and gorgeous outside, and you will be filled with learning and knowledge inside the building today from the presentations that you're about to hear. The tragedies that you hear about today are real, are genuine examples of local challenges to our survival here. So there are a couple of things about the symposium, again, that we do annually that I want you to know. First and foremost is that it is a collaboration between the Pikes Peak Library District Special Collections and the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum. And it's made possible each year with grant funding from a couple of different sources. So Tim mentioned the Helen James McCaffrey Fund, which we very much appreciated. Kathleen also mentioned our friends and our foundation group. Each year they also help us put on this event. We're also grateful to the Colorado Humanities for their ongoing support. I want to also mention that each year we have local partners in this event. Those local partners include the Historic Preservation Alliance, Pikes Peak Community College, Pikes Peak Genealogical Society, the Pikes Peak Posse of the Westerners, the Air Force Academy, UCCS, and the Western Museum of Mining and Industry. And we so appreciate their assistance each year as well. The final group that I'd like to thank for this event today is the amazing and remarkable staff that I am privileged to work with here at the Pikes Peak Library District. So in addition to our special collections staff who planned this event and do that each year, they do that with much assistance from several other departments in the district as well, including our Community Engagement and Outreach Office, Facilities and Security, Information Technology and Virtual Services, Finance and the Foundation Office, Special Collections. Chris Nickel, I want to particularly call you out and recognize your efforts for planning this event and organizing it every year. So you can see from that list that yes, it does take a library village to put this on for you. And now, on with the program. It is my privilege and honor to introduce our first speaker and our MC today, Dr. Michael Olson. Dr. Olson is Professor Emeritus at New Mexico Highlands University, where he taught a variety of American history courses from 1973 through 2012. From 2003 through 2007, Dr. Olson taught full-time at Pikes Peak Community College. He holds a BA from St. Olaf College and his master's and PhD from the University of Washington. He has had a long connection with the Santa Fe Trail and the Santa Fe Trail Association, and he's published extensively on trail history, particularly regarding social aspects and multicultural issues. Mike is also co-editor with us for Pikes Peak Library District's Regional History Series, the books that we publish each year as a result of these symposia. So please join me in welcoming Mike Olson.
Thank you, Paula, and good morning. I'm going to start with a story, a true story. Back when I was still teaching at Pikes Peak Community College, one day, a student walks in and she's clutching her forehead. My life is over, my life is over, it's a disaster, it's a disaster. She throws herself in her desk. And I thought, whoa, you know, car wreck on the way here, you know, histronics for my benefit, who knew? So I said, what's wrong? I lost my cell phone. My life is over, my life is over. I said, Well, seated behind her was another student, a man in his 40s, whom I'd gotten to know because he showed up early for every class and we'd chat. And I knew that, A, he'd lost his job a year before, and then discovered that his skill set, as we say, wasn't needed anymore. He had three children. He had a mortgage. He had a car payment, okay? And she's in there sobbing in front of him, and he reaches over and taps her on the shoulder and says, ma'am, can I change lives with you? Well, my function here this morning is to sort of set the scene for disasters of the Pikes Peak region. When Tim asked me if I do the introduction and sort of do the opening remarks and the opening paper, I thought, well, gee, what am I going to talk about? And I decided at the end of the day, your concept of what constitutes a disaster may be different than what you think constitutes a disaster now. We're going to be taking a look at a whole variety of disasters. And as the papers for this conference started coming in, I thought, well, maybe a good way to start would be, one, to define what we mean by disaster up front at the beginning of the morning. And then, since I'm a historian, I thought, I wonder if people's ideas of what constitutes a disaster has changed with time. Did our grandparents define disaster differently than we did? What about 500 years ago? What about 1500 years ago? And then, because I'm a social and cultural historian, I also thought, I wonder if other cultures think about disaster differently than Americans in the 21st century. If you're an islander in Vanuatu, or if you're in Serbia, where one of our speakers has just come from, then, you know, what does disaster mean as far as that's concerned? And so those are three questions I'm quickly going to take a look at. Definition, history, and the cultural situation as far as disaster is concerned. But let's begin here. Disaster struck in Colorado Springs on the morning of March 3, 1991. Shortly before 10 a.m., United Airlines Flight 585 was making its final approach to land at the Colorado Springs Airport, en route from Denver, when something went terribly wrong. The Boeing 737-200 rolled abruptly to the right and pitched nose downward toward the ground. The pilot attempted to pull out of the dive, but to no avail. Flight 585 then crashed violently at Widefield Park, some 4 miles south of the airport, narrowly missing an apartment complex. The crew of five and 20 passengers all died instantly. So horrific was the crash that El Paso County Sheriff Bernard Berry, commenting on the scene, said, quote, "We can't even find a chair. There's not a great deal of that airplane left." Initially, it was thought that some erratic wind shear or vortex brought the plane down, but in 1994, another Boeing 737-200 met a similar fate. The National Transportation Safety Board then determined that the failure of each plane's rudder power unit was at fault. Today, many people who lived then in the southern part of Colorado Springs can remember seeing the fireball, flames, and smoke. One family driving home from church on that clear Sunday morning saw the smoke coming from the direction of their house, and the father, as he now somewhat ruefully remembers given the circumstances, commented to his teenage daughter, "You left your curling iron on again, didn't you?" This particular plane crash has sort of a poignant coda to it for my wife and me. We knew the pilot. We'd been to his wedding. He married one of my wife's dearest friends from her childhood. His name was Hal Green. Well, I mentioned in taking a look at that disaster, the word disaster. And so, as I said, let's begin by defining disaster. And I'm not going to, you can read. But I looked up disaster in the dictionary and talked about widespread destruction and distress. And then I thought, what about synonyms? What, you know, going on? So catastrophe came up, and then tragedy. And I thought it was kind of interesting. Generally speaking, disaster seems to refer to something that has people really involved in it on a very personal level, whereas catastrophe seems to mean more something that nature brings down on us, a sudden violent change in the Earth's surface, a cataclysm, And then I thought it was interesting that when you looked up the definition of tragedy, you came around again to a disastrous event. So, you know, we use different words, and it would be interesting if I had an hour and you wanted to listen, to, you know, when do we use tragedy as opposed to disaster? When do we use disaster as opposed to catastrophe and that sort of thing? Okay. I also looked up the etymology of disaster, and it comes to us from the Greek through the Latin, disastra, bad stars, okay? And, you know, Tim referred to the Mayans and all our predictions and that sort of thing. And so in ancient Western world, people thought, whoa, the stars rule our lives. So if you've got some problem or there's been some bad thing happen, the stars have been bad. It's been disastra. Okay, so disaster. And since I'm of Norwegian heritage, I thought, well, I wonder what the Germanic roots of the word disaster are. So I looked up disaster in my Norwegian dictionary. And the Norwegian word for disaster is ulykke, which is nice and straightforward. Boy, you had some bad luck today. Too bad about that, you know, car accident. You're unlucky in the Germanic languages. We also, when we think of disaster and define disaster, probably call up some iconic image of a disaster. It would be different for different folks in here, maybe based on age, maybe based on where you were raised, maybe based on your cultural heritage. But of course, as we've already had mentioned this morning, the 100th anniversary of the Titanic, certainly a disaster. The Hindenburg, which I thought might be losing its credence as an iconic disaster as we move into the 21st century, and people seem to get younger and younger and younger. But we'll see in a little bit that that Hindenburg is still around. And by the way, you can go on YouTube and type in Hindenburg, and you can get the report that's so iconic with the reporter saying, oh, the humanity, oh, the humanity. And there at the bottom we have another disaster that we'll have reference to today. This is a breadline from the Great Depression. Disasters also for us, as I said earlier, have a personal face, an iconic picture of disaster, Dorothea Lange's photo of a migrant mother with her children, and then the disaster perhaps that is most fresh in our minds as a social disaster or a national disaster, the Twin Towers. And I'm going to refer back to that again in a minute or so. In defining a disaster, and since I'm a historian and books are important, I thought, I wonder what the literature of disaster is. And so I went to the fine card catalog online of the Pikes Peak Library District and typed in disaster and got some interesting ones. And I just put up the ones I thought were kind of quirky here. Terrifying steamboat stories, okay? Everything is going to kill everybody. And the one down here, disasters, man-made catastrophes through this, that's a children's book. I can't imagine. Okay, honey, let's go to sleep. Here, let's read about, oh my, 10,000 people died. I don't think it's not Good Night Moon, let's put it that way, okay? And then the great big book of horrible things is really, I ordered that one and read it. It really is a very good a book, and there are a lot of big horrible things out there that are covered in that particular one. But they're all right out here. During the break, you can go check them out. Also, when I was contemplating what to talk about, I thought, well, what does a disaster mean for me? When I think disaster, what comes to my mind? For me, it's fire. If we want to lie down on the couch, you can psychoanalyze me. Why fire? I don't know. I've never been in a fire or anything like that. But there are some fantastic historical accounts of fires. And of course, we were just reminded with the Queen's Jubilee of London and the past and everything. And one of the great historical, it gives me goosebumps just to talk about it, is Samuel Pepys' description of the Great Fire of London in 1666. Pepys is asleep in his home. The maids in the household wake Pepys and his wife up. They go up on the roof and they go, "Whoa, this is a bad fire." And then they go back to bed, okay? And then the next morning they get up and Pepys walks around London and he says, "Ooh, this really is bad." And then he goes home and goes back to bed. And then in the middle of the next night, the maids wake the family up and say, "You know, the fire's right down the block," and Pepys has to flee. I would love to have read the whole description. I've read the whole Pepys diary. It's fantastic. But Pepys writes, "About 4 o'clock in the morning, my lady Patton, a friend of his, sent me a cart to carry away all my money and plate and best things to Sir W. Ryder's at Bednall Green out in the country, which I did, riding myself in my nightgown in the cart. And Lord, to see how the streets and highways are crowded with people, running and riding and getting of carts at any rate to fetch things away." Sometime this summer, there's going to be another report on TV. The reporter's going to stick a microphone through a car window, and somebody's fleeing a fire, a forest fire. And they're going to say, all I could grab was the cat, or we didn't get out with anything. Think of Samuel Pepys, a disaster through time, and a disaster that affects humanity then as it did now. Another fire that came to mind when I was thinking about this talk was a prairie fire experienced by a woman named Lydia Spencer Lane. Lydia Lane, her husband was the commandant at Fort Union in New Mexico, and every summer she and the children went back east to Pennsylvania to visit the folks. I mean, it took 6 weeks to go across the plain, but they did it, okay? And in 1861, she's crossing the plains, and there's a prairie fire. She wrote, "The tents were pitched, and everything required for the night was put into them, beds made, etc. I had just gone into mine when I heard an unusual noise, and I went to the door to see what caused it. Will I ever forget the scene before me? The grass was on fire, and the flames, driven by the wind, leaped 100 feet at a time. It was a fearful sight. I knew instantly our only safety was in flight, and not a second must be wasted. As I left the tent, I seized such of the bedclothes as I could reach and threw them outside, took one child in my arms and the other by the hand. The servants followed, and by this time every woman and child in the camp had joined us. We fled down the side of a hill and into the water there camped along the Arkansas, which was nearly knee-deep, and the poor little children bravely struggling beside us, those who could walk, then up the opposite bank, never looking back till we had the water between us and the fire. Luckily, they lose everything, the civilians. The commissary train of the soldiers is not burned, and so they're, and the oxen don't get burned up either. So they're able to ride on to Kansas City in the wagon train. But she also says in here, "Those darn commissary wagons were 2 stories high, and it didn't look very ladylike when I had to climb in and out of them." And here's Lydia. This is Lydia Lane and her family at Fort Union. A third fire that I'll only just mention, when I was looking up Flight 585, the most deadly fire as far as loss of life in the history of Colorado Springs occurred on the very same day, the Crystal Springs Estate Fire. And I see people shaking their heads. Some of you may remember that particular fire. Well, 2 questions left then. As I said, I wanted to take a look at a definition of what is a disaster. Also, has it changed over time, and do other peoples or cultures define it differently than we do? I thought this was going to be the heart of my talk. I thought, boy, those are pretty good questions, Mike. Hey, you know. Turns out the answer to both of them is no. And there's not much to discuss. Gertrude Stein could have said, "A disaster is a disaster is a disaster. A disastrous fire in Rome is a disastrous fire in London is a disastrous fire in the forest up above Colorado Springs." So as human beings, we pretty much have experienced disaster the same over time. the nature of those disasters can change, particularly since the Industrial Revolution. We have many more technological disasters. Nobody died in a Fukushima incident, in 1500. Nobody died in an airplane crash in 1623. But a disaster is a disaster is a disaster. And culturally, well, I went to a search engine and I typed in cultural relativity disaster. And I got, well, I got 10,323 hits, but none of them meant anything. As it turns out, again, a disaster is a disaster is a disaster. But what I did find out is that there are cultural studies on how people process disasters. And we process disasters, as we found out during the tsunami in Japan, different than the Japanese process a disaster. We have different personal ways of responding to a disaster. Different organizations handle disasters in different ways. A village on a South Sea Island is going to handle a cyclone differently than Palm Beach is going to handle a hurricane. But as far as the people are concerned, a disaster is a disaster is a disaster. And then one final slide here. I love zits, okay? And it brings us full circle, okay? Art imitating life or life imitating art. I don't know which one it is. But just sort of a coda here that can perhaps move us on and remind you again to think about what we mean by disaster and how disasters affect us. We've got the Hindenburg, so it's still a lively icon. We've got the Titanic. And I looked at this and I thought, why did the cartoonist choose a tornado rather than, say, the Twin Towers, which would have been just as iconic and recognizable? And so I wonder, as we process disasters, are some of them so fresh, or some of them so personal, or some of them so traumatic that maybe it didn't occur to the cartoonist, or if it did, he thought, no, that's not appropriate. But 100 years from now, it will be used as an iconic picture of a disaster. So we're going to hear about a lot of different disasters here today. And as we go through, I hope you'll just think about what a definition is and how we process those disasters. Thanks. And now bear with me a second. Good morning, I'm Mike Olson, your MC, your moderator for today. I'll be introducing the speakers, and at the end of every session, we will have time for questions. I'll explain the procedure when we get there. Our first speaker this morning, I guess it's the second, I spoke, didn't I? Okay, is David Phillips. David is a native of Colorado Springs, who is an investigative journalist and author. He graduated from Middlebury College in 2000 and received a master's from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism in 2002. He joined the Colorado Springs Gazette in 2003 as the outdoor recreation writer, restaurant critic, and sometimes cartoonist. His job at the Gazette primarily included writing light features on activities like alligator wrestling, and that sounds like a disaster to me, boy. And helicopter skiing, an even worse disaster. In a pinch, he also writes long-term investigative pieces. He left the Gazette in 2011 to be a Ted Scripps Fellow at the University of Chicago, or Colorado, excuse me. His work has appeared in the Chicago Tribune, Denver Post, Los Angeles Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, Washington Post, and Daily Beast, among others. He has won awards from the Colorado Press Association, Colorado Associated Press Editors, and Reporters and Society of Professional Journalists. In 2008, he was given a National First Place Award for Best Feature Reporting for his coverage of the environment from the National Association of Sunday and Feature Editors. In 2010, he won the Livingston Award for National Reporting and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for his work on a cluster of soldiers returning from Iraq and being arrested for murder. David.
Thank you so much. I think what's maybe interesting about this year is we're going to talk a little bit about disasters that are not history but are ongoing. And this is certainly one I would include. It's a different type of disaster because I'm going to talk about soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan whose worlds are so upended that they've lost all sense of humanity. These are people that live in your town but probably not in your world. And it's funny to me that in modern times we can have this happen where we have two communities in one place with very little knowledge of each other. By the way, while I have the book up here, I'd like to say, if you want a signed copy of the book, please track me down during the break. I'll be here until lunch. I'm going to tell you the story of the Band of Brothers. This is the famous group of infantry guys from World War II, except they have the distinction of always being sent to the worst place in any conflict. They were in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II. They were in the middle of the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. And in Iraq, they were sent first to Al-Anbar province, which shorthand you could call Fallujah, at its worst, and then were sent back to Baghdad during its worst time. So they were always in the wrong place and took casualties at many times the rate of the rest of the army. And these soldiers, when they came back, had some real problems. And I'm going to detail them for you. And what I want you to take away from this is when I talk about soldiers, I'm talking about guys who are 19, 20, 21, all the guys I'm about to show you. So don't think adults. These guys would be coming to rent video games from the library here right now if they weren't in Afghanistan. Okay, so I was working at the Gazette in 2007 and 8, and we started to notice a large number of serious violent crimes coming out of Fort Carson. This is Anthony Marquez, arrested for shooting another 19-year-old in the heart over a disagreement of about $19. Lewis Bressler robbed and killed two other soldiers who he didn't even know. Kenny Eastridge, his good friend, implicated in a significant number of illegal killings in Iraq, was sent home from Iraq because he was too crazy to be in Iraq anymore. They figured he'd be better off back in Colorado Springs. Implicated in a number of armed robberies and murders. Their medic and friend, Bruce Bastian, ran a woman down with his car and stabbed her repeatedly. Jomar Vives liked to get drunk and drive around southeastern Colorado Springs with an AK-47 randomly shooting people. Shot four, killed two. This is all within the span of a year. John Needham beat his girlfriend to death. Rudy Torres helped Jomar Vives cover everything up, was his driver during all of his episodes. When the police arrested him, he said he didn't think it was that big of a deal. They had done similar things in Iraq. Jose Barco, 19, blown up twice in Iraq, being treated for PTSD by the Army, but also being discharged, got in a fight at a party, was thrown out, and then returned to empty his pistol on the party, ended up shooting a pregnant woman. And Robert Marco took a woman he met online up Gold Camp Road, slit her throat, and dumped her body down into a canyon. I don't have as much time as I usually have, so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to read you a scene from Iraq that these guys experienced so that maybe you can try and put together these two very strange things. I do have to tell you a few things first, though. I'm going to use a couple of strange vocab words. First is I'm going to use the word saw. And when I use it, picture a medium-sized machine gun. It's called a squad automatic weapon, not a wood saw. All these guys were sent to patrol a piece of highway that looks almost exactly like the highway going between here and Pueblo, divided four-lane modern highway. They called it Route Michigan. It was so full of burned-out cars and craters that it reminded them of a bad 80s movie they had all watched a number of times. And they called their mission Operation Mad Max. one more thing, and I always have to say this because for some reason saying it first makes it easier to do later. I'm going to use terrible language that these guys used. I'm going to talk about terrible things because that is their life. So I'm going to take you to 2004. We're going to eastern Iraq, the desert between Ramadi and Fallujah. This is one of the guys I'll be talking about, Kenny Eastridge, right before they deployed. At this point, he's 19. And there he is, patrolling Route Michigan. By the end of the week, when Kenny Eastridge learned his platoon was going back on 3 days of Mad Max, everybody was on edge. They had been trained early on to protect themselves from ambushes by watching for anything out of the ordinary. Problem was, they also learned pretty quickly that almost everything in their corner of Iraq was out of the ordinary. Every day, the soldiers struggled to find meaningful hints of what was normal in their patrol areas. Three people, dressed head to toe in black robes, their faces covered except for glaring eyes. Was that normal? Seven men in headscarves packed into taxis. Was that normal? A burning mound of trash in the middle of the street with goats foraging around the edges. Was that normal? And then some of the things that appeared the most normal could be the most deadly. A person on a cell phone, a boy on a bicycle, a lone driver in a car, a clear strip of highway. Any of them could mean an impending bomb attack, or not. There was no normal. The platoon learned pretty quickly an important survival lesson. The locals usually knew when an IED attack was about to happen. So if they were out in the street, it was a sign everything was safe. But if the street is deserted, one sergeant said, like a Wild West movie, you better pucker your because you're about to get blown up. Several hours into their patrol, the captain called on the radio. The battalion had a tip that a group of insurgents in a car packed with explosives was on its way from Ramadi to Fallujah. He wanted to meet the platoon just west of a small town called Chaldea to set up a roadblock. So the platoon rolled down a stretch of Route Michigan just blocks from a bullet-pocked mosque they had raided the day before and parked their three Humvees along the side of the highway. This is Chaldea. There, they began to block off traffic coming out of Ramadi. 19-year-old Jose Barco, a kid from Miami, and two other soldiers pulled on leather gloves. They heaved a big coil of razor wire off the hood of one of their trucks and began stringing it across the pavement. Kenny Eastridge stood guard a few feet away with his big saw gun at the ready. On his side of the street, a few bullet-riddled houses baked in the sun. On the other side, a cluster of pathetic-looking shops rippled in the heat, their owners staring at the soldiers through the windows. Eastridge's job was to stand watch over his sergeant, Sean Huey, while the sergeant directed the traffic search. At the moment, he was conferring with the platoon sergeant about where to put an observation post. The street was full of people in cars. Women in long black hijabs ambled in and out of the shops. A group of children played nearby in the dust. If there was a normal, this looked close to it. It was a sign that, despite previous days of violence, everything was well. The platoon's medic, 20-year-old Ryan Krebs, walked up next to Eastridge and asked the sergeant if he could smoke a cigarette. "Eastridge," the sergeant barked, "go take this guy down the alley and give him a smoke." So Eastridge and Krebs ducked past the platoon sergeant's Humvee, which was parked at the mouth of a narrow mud brick alley, and walked several paces down the corridor to sit on the toppled wall of a half-destroyed house. On the wide lanes of Route Michigan, Jose Barco pulled the dancing coil of razor wire across the hot pavement. Other soldiers stood in the waves of heat, hands resting on their rifles. "Hey, Barco, can I borrow your gloves?" a soldier said. Barco turned his head to answer. It was the last thing he remembers. At that moment, a suicide bomber's car was speeding down Route Michigan. He veered across the median, aimed at the Humvee blocking the alley, and released his detonation trigger. Instantly, a flash of heat and concussion shattered the shop windows. Soldiers felt it before they heard it as a shockwave slapped them to the ground. Glass and metal flew everywhere, fire swallowed the roadblock. The force rippled up the alley and hurled Ryan Krebs and Kenny Eastridge to the dirt. They were hit so hard that at first they thought someone had tossed a grenade on their heads. Everyone lay dazed in a fog of dust as their shaken brains reset. It lasted only a second or two, but seemed to stretch for minutes. "Are you okay?" Eastridge finally said to the medic as he pulled himself up on his knees. The medic started patting himself for holes. "I don't know, am I?" he said. "Yeah," Eastridge said. He looked at his own uniform. "Am I?" Krebs scanned Eastridge for wounds and his eyes glanced up over his head to a huge, thick cloud of black smoke rising from the street. "Oh," he said. Eastridge whipped around and saw the oily smoke. He grabbed Krebs by the shoulder and they sprinted down the alley into the cloud. Confusion hung thick. Krebs followed Eastridge as they squeezed past the mangled, burning wreck of the Humvee. The suicide bomber's car was nowhere to be seen. The blast had destroyed it almost completely. As Krebs and Eastridge edged into the street, tiny pieces of metal pelted down through the mist of smoke and dust like a scorching rain. Silhouettes of bodies materialized in the haze, some moving, some not. An Iraqi woman appeared through the gloom, weeping as she tried to drag two children out of the road. The limp, ragged bodies had been cut into pieces, limbs left on the asphalt in a slick of oil, fuel, and blood. Krebs groped past the woman and farther into the kill zone. American soldiers always came first. From every direction, the platoon dashed towards the blast site while wailing civilians stumbled away. Krebs and Eastridge found the platoon sergeant yelling for the soldiers to get their rifles up and ready for another attack. The sergeant sat on the ground with his hands raised in the air. Several of the fingers hung only by strips of skin. Blood streamed out of his mouth. Shrapnel had torn open his calf. Spreading blotches of blood on his uniform showed where shards of the now obliterated car had shot into his body. All Army medics are trained to divide casualties into three simple categories. Those who are going to die no matter what you do, those who are going to live no matter what you do, and those who may live or die depending on what you do at that moment. Bloody or not, the sergeant was going to live, at least for now. Krebs told a nearby soldier to give the sergeant some morphine and bandage his wounds, and then he pushed on. Krebs passed another soldier whose cheek had been sliced open by shrapnel and hung down, revealing the bloody jaw beneath. A shard of metal was stuck in the jawbone. He too was going to live. Krebs kept going to another soldier who was bleeding from his face and eyes, yelling, "I can't see! I can't see!" He was going to live. The medic hurried towards a pile of burning wreckage, where some other soldiers, half obscured by acrid smoke, were wrestling hot razor wire off of a tangle of bodies. Krebs took a half step towards the car, then saw his squad leader, Sean Huey, who had been standing, suddenly crumpled to the ground. The medic hurried over and knelt down. He saw blood spurting from the sergeant's left thigh. He was paper white and gulping like a trout. Krebs probed along the right thigh. A chunk of the car had punched right through both legs, right below the pelvis, clipping the main arteries. Blood was flowing out in a spreading pool on the ground. If the sergeant didn't get care right now, he was going to die. Krebs tried to apply pressure to stop the bleeding and watched his whole hand just sink into the wound. Kenny Eastridge stood nearby, scanning with his saw along the bullet-pocked building still glaring down at Route Michigan. He was waiting for the rest of the ambush. His barrel passed over the medic frantically working on his favorite sergeant. It passed over the charred, ragged Iraqis bleeding on the road. It passed over the smoking wreckage where the soldier with blood dripping from his cuts was yelling, "They're burning! They're burning! Help me! They're burning!" In the wreckage, Eastridge's eyes fell on his friend Jose Barco. The 19-year-old kid was pinned by the flaming front end of the suicide bomber's car. Eastridge watched Barco heave away the wreckage with the help of two soldiers. Then the private somehow stood up, wobbling in shock, blood soaking into his uniform from 100 jagged bits of car that had hit him like a shotgun blast. Eastridge heard Barco start yelling, "I'll kill those. I'll kill those. Somebody give me my weapon. I'll kill those." Half of his uniform was still on fire. Eastridge kept his gun leveled at the growing crowd of locals on the scene there to collect their dead. I'm sorry, I'm short on time, so I'm just going to slip slightly ahead. The captain said that no one in the platoon was leaving until sundown. They were going to guard the chunks of the suicide bomber's body slung all over the block. In the Muslim faith, he said, a person must be buried until before sundown to go to heaven. He suspected the friends of the bomber were waiting to bury their latest martyr, and the band of brothers was not going to let that happen. They stayed for hours guarding the gruesome scene. A few locals tried to collect pieces of the suicide bomber's body in buckets. The soldiers raised their rifles and ordered them to dump the buckets back on the asphalt. As the sun went down, Eastridge tried to keep himself squared away. He was guarding the same alley where the blast had knocked him to the dirt. Now in the failing light, a spine lay in the narrow passage between the walls. No flesh, no ribs, no explanation, just a human spine. Was it the bomber's or someone else's? He didn't know. Eastridge's battalion had spent months preparing for Iraq, and here they were, totally unprepared. He was trained to fight an army and had been in an attack that had wounded several soldiers and killed a man he had counted on most, but he had not been able to fire a shot in defense. Guns were almost useless en route Michigan. There was no good way to defend against a roadside bomb or a suicide bomber. All the training to outshoot, outmaneuver, and outthink enemy soldiers proved futile because the enemy in Iraq was not a soldier. He was a shadow, a disease that wafted invisibly through the civilian population. It made Eastridge furious that the locals let these scumbags hide in their midst. He was enraged that they had killed his favorite sergeant, Sergeant Huey, his mentor, his leader, the one he had looked to for answers. And now his platoon sergeant was out of the picture too. They still had 8 months left in Iraq, Eastridge thought to himself. Who would lead the platoon? What would they do? He felt faint. He put his hand down on a crumbled wall next to him to steady himself and felt something warm and wet in his palm. He had leaned into a piece of lung or liver or something, he didn't know what. Oh God, he said. He jerked away his hand and wiped the blood in a long smear down the wall. This is not what he had signed up for. He felt even fainter. He went to steady himself and put his hand right back in the liver. So that was one day in one tour. And the guys I showed you had first a 12-month tour and then a 15-month tour. And guess what they did the next day after the day I just read to you? They went back en route Michigan again. Kenny Eastridge was eventually blown out of this Humvee. He was sitting up top. Surprisingly, war never happens how you expect. The explosion blew him down through the turret and out the front door. He went back on patrol the next day. They got home. They got a warm welcome from us, and we as a society decided that a warm welcome would be enough. We decided that not welcoming home people in Vietnam was the cause of the problems in Vietnam, and so if we gave them these parties, that would do the job. And then we sent them back. This is second tour for Kenny Eastridge. Jose Barco, even though he got blown up by that car, also went back for a second tour. If you look carefully at his hand, you can see some of the burn marks. They went back to the worst place again and experienced a lot of the same stuff. They didn't feel like heroes. They started turning into people who you would probably describe as homicidal maniacs. Kenny Eastridge boasted to me in jail that he had killed about 75 people in Iraq. There's one. He got a lot of tattoos. This one says, born to die, ready to kill. There's the guns he brought back from Iraq. His friends who all eventually were arrested for murder. There he is the day he was kicked out of the army. A big difference from a few years before. We don't have as much time as we'd all probably like, which collectively is probably a good thing. And this is a real complex issue. So if you want to know more about this sort of untold history of recent Colorado Springs, I encourage you to read the book. I will just say that the Army responded to this and has tried to make it better, but so far has largely failed. We still have a very large number of violent crimes coming out of this unit, a few notable in the last 3 months. Brian Jones, this is just in the last couple weeks, arrested for strangling dogs, which he told the police he would do to quell his homicidal rages. And three soldiers from the unit were recently arrested for shooting a man in the back. So I'm going to stop right there, but there's a lot going on in a disaster that is still unfolding. Thank you very much.